Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts on the network. And today I'm interviewing Mark Lawrence Schrod for the Drugs, Addiction, and Recovery podcast. Dr. Schrod is an associate professor of political science at Villanova University and is the author of Smashing the Liquor Machine, A Global History of Prohibition, which is the third book in a trilogy and is just out from Oxford University Press. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. This is going to be fun.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us just a little bit about yourself and how you came to study prohibition.
I'm originally from the Midwest, from Iowa. Not that that has any relevance to the prohibition angle. Did my undergraduate work at the University of Northern Iowa and had a big interest in Russia, Russian politics. So I started going to Russia in the 1990s, learned Russian, spent a lot of time there. That was kind of my focus. And if you spend any time in Russia, you start to learn about vodka really quickly. And sort of the social impacts that it has. So I was really interested in, sort of that core question of, alcohol consumption. Like why do Russians drink so much vodka? So that was kind of the framework that kind of led me down sort of these different academic paths. I went and got my master's degree at Georgetown, worked with a guy named Murray Feshbach, who's a wonderful human. He was sort of the cream of the crop of Russian demographers or demographers of Russia when it comes to health and health and epidemiology. And so the guy just had a knack for finding sort of the inside information first about the Soviet Union, then about Russia. That's kind of set me on this focus on sort of the confluence of alcohol and politics and history in many ways in sort of global context. So that's just kind of where the whole thing began, and it is kind of stuck with me through my dissertation and then my first couple of books. One was kind of this focus on Russia and Russian politics. The other was on, alcohol and alcohol politics. Even in terms of being very, very young and taking courses in civics and history, the whole idea of, I looked at the U.S. Constitution is kind of like the received wisdom of generations of Americans about sort of best practices, and then you go through all the amendments and they all sort of make sense, as you go through and we're trying to fix things and make things, better. 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery, 14th Amendment, equal rights. And then, 16th Amendment, you're getting into taxation and then you get to the 18th Amendment and it says, no selling alcohol. And I was like, what? Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to make any sense. Okay. Well, whatever, just kind of keep going. 19th Amendment. Okay. Women can vote. Makes sense. Okay, good. And then you get to 21st Amendment. It's like, oh yeah, forget that 18th. I'm like, okay, well, what happened there? None of this makes any sense to me in hindsight. So so that became sort of the focus of trying to understand prohibition politics in sort of a broader and more comparative context.
So tell us about Smashing the Liquor Machine in particular and how you came to write this book.
So, yeah, so this was sort of the outcome of the the whole process. I wanted to recognize that a lot of the narratives that we have about alcohol politics in the United States just don't make any sense when you apply them to the rest of the world. So sort of the conventional wisdom about, you know, why did we have alcohol prohibition in the United States? What was that 18th Amendment all about? You know, the historical conventional wisdom is that if you want to explain prohibitionism in the United States, well, you just have to look at Bible-thumping, conservative, Midwestern, evangelical Protestants. And I was like, okay, well, coming from Russia, you know, Russia was the first country in the world to have prohibition, and they don't have any Bible-thumping, Midwestern, evangelical Protestants. And in fact, you know, knowing a little bit about the Russian case and having already written a book on it, I was finding just the exact opposite, that it was, you know, sort of, it was an anti-authoritarian movement. So people like Leo Tolstoy were prohibitionists and Lenin was a prohibitionist. And these are not Bible thumpers. These are not evangelicals. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, well, you know, and knowing just a little bit about some of these different other kind of global experiences, I wanted to say, okay, well, we think we know what causes prohibition in the American context. Let's put that on the shelf for now. What interested me, I was like, okay, let's look and see what causes prohibition in the rest of the world. And then at the end of the day, see if there's anything that we can learn from sort of the international experience that we can use to enrich sort of our American, you know, history. And so that was the idea originally, was just to kind of look around the globe and see what prohibition looks like in Germany, in the, you know, sort of the German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the British Empire. Look at it in India and Australia you know, South Africa and Ireland, and see what it is, you know, in all these different places. And the original proposal was only about half as long as the full book was supposed to be. It's only supposed to be like 8 chapters. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just like a nice, tidy, you know, conclusion chapter of, hey, you know, we've just kind of taken a tour around the globe and looked at temperance and prohibition politics. And this is what we learn, and this is how it applies to the United States. But something weird happens when you do that, is that it completely upends, you know, the entire understanding of temperance and prohibition as a conservative, you know, reactionary movement against, you know, immigration and modernization, which is kind of the way that's couched in the United States. But you find really quickly that it was just the opposite. It was a revolutionary movement in many ways. It was, you know, temperance was kind of this weapon of the weak and the oppressed. It was, you know, anybody who didn't have political power, you know, rallied around this, you know, opposition to sort of the predatory capitalism of, you know, what, you know, they talk about as the liquor machine. You know, it's not just the alcohol, it's the business of making outlandish profits based upon, you know, getting people addicted to stuff. And so once you take that viewpoint, you're like, oh, okay, wait a minute. This is, you know, completely opposite from what I was ever told. And you start to see American history in sort of a completely new light. And it you know, you start to recognize that, you know, not only are the roots of prohibitionism in the United States much, much deeper than we're conventionally told, but it's much more diverse than what we're conventionally told. And so, you know, that's where, you know, this, you know, I kind of gave a presentation here in the department once with sort of what was the first half of the book. And I thought was, you know, the entire book at that point in time. And, you know, one of my colleagues sat down and she says, okay, well, if I'm to believe your thesis that temperance and prohibitionism was not about, you know, conservative Bible thumping evangelicals, but it was a movement of, you know, sort of indigenous protection and women's rights and African-American rights, civil rights, and sort of indigenous protections. She says, where are the Native Americans in your story? And I was like, I don't have a good answer to that. And that was the moment where this book essentially doubled in length is like, okay, well, I should go and look at that to, you know, see if this thesis holds water in the United States. We should look at sort of these indigenous communities. We should look at Native American populations. Once you do that, you find that, you know, the first prohibitionists in this country were Native Americans. And that entire lineage of prohibitionism goes back even before the founding of the United States. And so that's where it became like this, okay, well, we have to now look at sort of the very deep elements of American history, as in addition to sort of a global history as well.
You have a great quote. I'm just going to read it right now. I'll just read your book back to you. Mm-hmm. That really sums that up. You say, "The history of American temperance and prohibition stretches back many generations before the 19th and early 20th centuries, which is when most traditional prohibition histories began. And rather than temperance being an effort by white evangelicals to quote unquote discipline marginalized and minority communities, it was an effort led by those very communities to oppose their own political and economic subjugation." That's quite a claim. The subtitle of this book is A Global History of Prohibition. I feel like it could also be Everything You Think You Know About Prohibition Is Wrong. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what is the dominant historical narrative about alcohol prohibition? Where does it come from? And then what's wrong with it? And here, this is New Books Network. So if you wanna get in the weeds and talk about Richard Hofstadter, you know, that's perfectly fine.
Sure. Yeah. I should say that the subtitle is kind of a lie. The book is a global history of, it says it's prohibition, but it's actually prohibitionism. Right. My interest was in sort of the motivations, what led people to be on the side of temperance and prohibitionism. And so it doesn't really get into, you know, there's no Al Capone. It kind of ends with the 18th Amendment. Right. So it doesn't go into that, you know, the 13 year span of looking at, sort of speakeasies and jazz age stuff that you get in the Ken Burns documentary series as much. I was just more interested in trying to figure out what motivated these people and how we could better understand, you know, the process of getting, not only a constitutional amendment passed and all the, hurdles that go with that, but also, you know, sort of the international elements of this transnational movement in that way. So it was, you know, in terms of, like I said, the conventional wisdom in the United States has been for a long time that this was sort of this conservative evangelical movement. I remember when, in 2016, in November 2016, when Donald Trump was elected, watching, and a lot of people were shocked, obviously, by this electoral outcome. And CNN contributor Van Jones was on TV, and he said that he had this great phrase. He said this was a white lash against, a changing United States. That's what the election of Donald Trump was. It was sort of a rejection of sort of multiculturalism and all these sorts of things by sort of white nativist conservative evangelicals. And I was like, that is a perfect, you know, in that one word, white lash, that essentially summed up the dominant approach, the received wisdom on why we had prohibitionism. You know, it was this, you know, the way we're told is that it was this, a movement, sort of the last gasp, a symbolic crusade of, you know, again, Midwestern conservative evangelicals looking to discipline the leisure of other communities, other religions, other, you know, immigrants and minority populations in the United States. And so that, you know, that has just been kind of, like I said, the received wisdom just doesn't really hold up internationally all that well. I had a colleague of mine, and I was at a conference in London and kind of presenting some of the early results of these insights that, hey, maybe this wasn't, you know, a conservative evangelical movement. A colleague of mine, who's now I count as a close friend, She had just finished her dissertation in Mexico. She teaches in Mexico City. Looking at her question was, in Mexico, why is it in 1917 in Mexico, you've got a predominantly Catholic country. In 1917, they have, you know, they've gone through the revolution. They've had a very ultra progressive constitution at that point in time. And it had provisions against, you know, alcohol, against the liquor traffic in Mexico. And so she says, okay, well, you know, I was interested in this question of why we have restrictions on alcohol in Mexico. So I borrowed from the Americans. You know, the Americans know what causes temperance and prohibitionism in their country, we would assume. And so the Americans tell us that prohibitionism is, you know, caused by Bible thumpers, right? Evangelical Protestants. And so she focused her entire dissertation on searching for essentially American missionaries in Mexico as the explanation for this outcome. And she found maybe like 20 of them in the entire country. There weren't a whole lot. And certainly not enough to sort of, you know, change the course of, you know, sort of constitution of Mexico. And she, I remember she said, you know, I really wish that we had had this understanding beforehand, because it would have made my world, you know, her work a whole lot easier on that side. So, so that was kind of, you know, the approach was to kind of take this idea that we know a lot about ourselves and our own history, and just kind of, like I said, just kind of put that on the shelf and try to understand what's going on in the rest of the globe and see whether or not it actually holds up in American context.
Okay, well, that's a really nice segue to my next question, which is, for our listeners who can't see the book as we're having this conversation, it is a tome. It is 735 pages long. It is the kind of book where just sort of carrying it around with me made me feel smarter, made me feel like a smarter person, that I was, you know, amassing all of this history. And I wonder if you could tell us about your research and writing process, because you visited a lot of archives. It's international in scope. But you position Smashing the Liquor Machine as a work of comparative politics rather than of history. So can you tell us a little bit about why?
Sure. So it's been unusual in this way, right? So I'm, you know, I got my PhD in 2007 from the University of Wisconsin in political science. So I guess by that account, I'm a political scientist, not a historian. And I recognize that, you know, academics in many ways are very territorial, right? So historians, I like to think about it in terms of sandboxes. You know, historians don't like it when political scientists play in their sandbox. Political scientists don't like it when economists play in our sandbox, right? It's very bizarre and very territorial. But within the discipline of political science, there are very few people who are interested in the topic of alcohol politics and prohibitionism. There's just nobody out here doing it, right? And so I end up oftentimes being like the only political scientist or somebody with political science training in the social sciences at conferences full of historians. And what I hope I can bring to the table, you know, I think the difference between the two disciplines is, you know, it is more of an approach, right? And sort of a methodology more than anything else. And so history, I think nowadays is more about sort of getting into sort of the nitty gritty. What were experiences like? You know, I remember I sat down with a top historian of Russia, and when I was writing my previous book on vodka politics, I wanted to pick his brain because this is a guy who's written 5 books on the Russian revolutions, right? You know, the Bolshevik Revolution. And so I invited him out for beers, and so we went out, had some beers, and I wanted to pick his brain. I said, okay, so I'm going to write this chapter on the Russian Revolution. Tell me, what is sort of the state of the art in history when it comes to the causes of the Russian Revolution? And he just kind of laughed at me, you know, in a nice way, not a mocking way and anything like that. He says, Mark, nobody in history has asked that question in 30 years. You know, what caused the Russian Revolution? We're not interested in causation in history. He's like, that's what political science does. They want to ask these how, what, where, when, why questions. You know, what causes revolutions to happen? And, you know, trying to understand these things in sort of a broader, more comparative context. And he says, you know, for historians, you know, the cutting edge of history on the Russian Revolution is, you know, what was it like to be a worker in Petrograd in 1917? What was that kind of finely grained historical experience like? And I love those works. I love to read those works. But it doesn't answer those questions that I have, which are, again, sort of a broader sort of causal element. What causes prohibition? What causes revolutions to happen? And so, you know, so I spend and I teach a lot of courses that try to suss out this question of causation, you know, what leads to, you know, this particular outcome. And so, you know, when it comes to, I guess, this question of prohibition and prohibitionism, for me, it came down to one of sample size. Right. So if you think about it, you know, we can get into American history and look at prohibition in the United States. But ultimately, if you take a broader global perspective, just focusing in on the United States, that's a sample size of one, right? And it's the question then is, how representative is this single sample of this one case that we have of prohibition in the United States? And so the approach then was not so much to take what we think we know from a single sample and then try to extrapolate it to the rest of the world, like we did with, you know, my friend did in Mexico. You know, if we want a more reliable understanding of what's causing what, we take a bigger, broader sample, just like, you know, you would if you're a pollster, right? You get a more representative understanding if you take a sample of, you know, 500 likely voters in, you know, in terms of what they're going to vote in the 2022 midterms, as opposed to just asking, you know, your crazy uncle, right? Your crazy uncle may not be representative of sort of the broader elements. And so that was the idea. It was like, I want to take a bigger, broader sample. I want to see what prohibitionism is like in the rest of the world, rather than extrapolating from a sample size of one. And then see if there's anything we can generalize and kind of take from that. So that was my hope, as, you know, saying that this was a work of comparative politics rather than being just sort of a work of history. It's not just kind of looking at one, you know, one case after another, but it was, you know, I want to look at, you know, not just what's going on in the United States. I want to look at what's going on in the Russian Empire. I want to look at what's going on in Sweden and in Belgium and in Germany and Austria. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, I want to look at the Turkish, you know, the Ottoman Empire. I want to look at South Africa and India and Australia. And I want to look at all these different experiences to make sure that we have a broader, more representative sample of what the actual causal dynamics are in that case. And so that was the idea behind it. That was the approach. And that's, again, more of a, you know, sort of a comparative politics approach to, you know, to a question rather than sort of a more narrow historical approach to it.
And so the methodological approach really also informs the book's structure, which I think is quite creative. So for our listeners, Smashing the Liquor Machine has three parts, and it's kind of cyclical, I would say, in the sense that it begins with the United States and then it ends with the United States. The first section of the book is called The Continental Empires and has a focus on Russian history. The second section of the book is called The British Empire and focuses on British colonialism. And then the third and final section of the book sort of brings us back to the United States and what we can glean, you know, what we can say about U.S. history having taken a broader and more global view. Why do we need to learn about temperance and prohibition in Russia and in Russian and in British history before we can really fully understand the history of prohibition in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is like a, you know, this is a journey, really, you know, more than anything. I think before I got into, you know, sort of the academic enterprise, I just always assumed that, you know, when you see a book, that this is something that, you know, the author knew, you know, that they had all this knowledge and then they just kind of funnel it in there and they package it up nicely and so on. And I don't think that's the case. Certainly is not the case in my estimation, right? And so, or in my situation, it was more, I've got this question and I want to go find an answer to it. And so the book is kind of, it's more of a journey, kind of taking you through this whole thing. And so it really was in many ways sort of, you know, the journey to learning more about ourselves. And I guess that's the other standard trope that you hear about, like, you know, comparative politics and study abroad opportunities, that we go abroad to learn more about ourselves, because there's always that kind of implicit comparison. You know, if you're doing if you're studying abroad in India or studying abroad in Prague or wherever it is, you know, that there's always this kind of, oh, okay, well, this is what's going on in this country. I wonder how that's different from, you know, what I was told, or what, you know, how I understand politics or history or culture and so on and so forth. So that's, you know, that was kind of the, you know, sort of the broader approach. And I think it's important, you know, I guess another element that came out of this is that there, you know, there are 18 chapters in the book. You know, and it is a huge book, and I apologize.
It's a great book. It all needs to be there.
Yeah. And that was the thing is that, you know, people suggested that, hey, you know, half the book is on American politics, and half of it's sort of international politics. Why don't you make it two books? Well, for one, you know, I was under contract for one book. And so they weren't exactly going to let me get away with it. But even if they could, I think that especially like for an American audience, you know, we tend to focus so much on our own history, and that sort of narrowness is like, it doesn't make sense unless it all comes together. Right. You know, that, and, throughout the book, I've got like these shout outs, you know, that, you know, that's, you know, if you're reading a section on, you know, on sort of the social gospel socialism in the United States, you know, it's hard to understand that without knowing a little bit about Leo Tolstoy. Right. And so I'll have a shout out saying, OK, you know, making reference to chapter 2, where we talk about Tolstoy, or chapter 7, where we're talking about Gandhi, or talking about all these different things. Because, you know,
I'll just interject here and say, this is very helpful. There are these parentheticals throughout the entire book where Mark kind of redirects the reader to where themes come up in other places. So like, see chapter 2, see chapter 1, see. So the way that it's all woven together is really elegant. Anyway, go on.
And I thought, you know, actually for a while, I thought, you know, when it came out in, I bounced this thought off my editor, and he was not as enamored with it as I was, but I was like, what if we made those hyperlinks? And then you could do like a, you know, make your own story. Or build your own adventure, right? And so you could be reading through, you know, chapter 7, and then it says, you know, here's a reference to, you know, here's a reference to Tolstoy in chapter 2. And then you could click on that, and it would take you to that part, right? And so you could just kind of explore it in a multi-directional way rather than having it being one chapter after another. And he's like, no, that's not how books work. And I'm like, okay. We're not going to change how a book works, you know. In 2021. All right. But you know, but it was an idea, right? That, you know, we've got these sort of shout outs. And part of it is, again, that I think it needs to make sense altogether. And you know, to have those other experiences. You know, and part of it was to sort of short circuit some of these critiques that I'm sure would be coming. That say, okay, well, that's all well and good for Russia, or that's all well and good for Sweden, but I'm interested in the United States, and this is what we think is happening. It's like, well, no, you can't take sort of the American experience and put it up on a pedestal and completely discount everything else that's out there. You know, it only makes sense if it kind of all hangs together. And so that was, you know, part of the reason for, you know, for making it so big. Was to get sort of a flavor for these different international experiences. And it's certainly not exhaustive. You know, there's not, I'm sure you could find more information on, you know, sort of West Africa or Burma or, you know, Latin America. But then there would be a 1,000-page book, right?
Right.
Really what it to write that. So I did want to sort of, you know, get sort of a good sample of experiences around the globe, but also try to use each of those chapters to kind of build a sort of an overlapping narrative, right? So like the first, case that we, you know, you have the introduction that kind of sets the stage and gives us a sense of the scope and where the argument is going. And then I take the readers all the way to Russia. Right. And so part of that is I'm a Russia guy, you know, but also I figure for an American readership, there is nothing further away from sort of, you know, the comfortable historical experiences of American history than taking you halfway around the world and plunking you in the middle of Siberia. Right. And so let's get as far away from the American experience as we can, and see what it looks like in the Russian Empire and sort of, you know, when it comes to the rise of communism and so on. So chapter two looks at sort of, you know, temperance and anti-czarist, anti-autocracy right there, and communism. And then, you know, the next section looks at Sweden and the rise of social democracy. And then the next chapter looks at, you know, Germany and Austro-Hungary, where it becomes, you know, less of a socialist movement and more of a liberal movement. So each of these chapters is not only supposed to be sort of geographically representative, but also give sort of a different sense of sort of the political motivations in each of these areas as well. So trying to double up and try to make not only a geographic point, but also, sort of an understanding of the political motivations in all these places too.
Well, so Smashing the Liquor Machine, it sets out to sort of to bust a lot of myths about Prohibition's history, and in sort of reinforcing your argument again and again throughout the book, results in some very kind of quotable passages. You write things like temperance and anti-imperialism go hand in glove. Vodka became synonymous with Russian culture, not because the Russian people demanded it, but because the state supplied it. You come to some conclusions about Ireland, which were surprising to me as someone of Irish heritage, that Irish independence was born of temperance, things like this. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about whether the lines like these are a signal that the book is a polemic. In other words, how do you show the reader, or how can you show us that you've considered alternate points of view in terms of what was alcohol doing for, were there positive benefits of alcohol? What was alcohol doing for people? Or was it just solely all the way around the world a tool of sort of imperial oppression?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting question, and some of it's sort of, you know, stylistics and trying to challenge these preconceptions. But one of the things that I think is that this kind of global perspective gives us is that it highlights some of the shortcomings in our own understandings and our own sort of, you know, received wisdom when it comes to temperance and prohibitionism. Because usually, you know, even the terminology that we use, we say alcohol prohibition, right? It's a prohibition against alcohol. But if you go back and read, you know, what temperance folks and prohibitionists were talking about at that point in time, rarely did they ever use that phrase alcohol prohibition. And that always seemed a little weird to me. And at some point, again, sort of based on this comparative perspective, it clicked. They always talk about, they don't talk about alcohol. They talk about the liquor traffic. And somewhere along the lines, we've lost that word traffic. And so, you know, they would argue that, that's, I'm not against drinking, like a prohibitionist would say, whether it's in the United States or whether it's in Germany or whether it's in Russia or wherever. They say, I'm not against alcohol. I'm against the liquor traffic, right? People, if they want to drink in their own house, that's up to them. You know, that's their own individual choice. But they say, what I'm against is trafficking in alcohol, right? Getting people addicted to stuff. And so it was, the question wasn't one of being opposed to the liquor that's in the bottle. They didn't see that as evil. And they didn't see the drinker as a sinner. They saw it, and this goes all the way back to the foundings of temperance, as, you know, the one who was the wrongdoer was the person who was doing the selling and getting people addicted for private, you know, for private profit. And so causing immense social and societal harms for private profit. And so that was sort of the thing that I guess in one case, when we were talking about sort of the polemic side of it, is that, you know, recognizing that it wasn't so much just about, you know, the role of alcohol in society, because there are certainly, you know, a lot of positives that you could look at in terms of, you know, being a social lubricant and, you know, whatnot. But when it came to sort of the predations of, you know, sort of using alcohol to get people addicted and then, you know, keeping them at the saloon until they, you know, drank up all their worldly possessions, you know, that was a bit of a problem, right? And so that was in some ways trying to recognize, hey, I think we've been focusing on the wrong thing here. We've been focusing on, you know, the alcohol in the bottle rather than the process of making money off of it. And so that was kind of, you know, the shift that I was trying to reinforce there, you know, in terms of this. But there are also, I guess, in terms of it being a sort of a polemic in terms of, you know, sort of offering some kind of highly charged, maybe contrarian views, you know, once you kind of take this this perspective, it really highlights a lot of the sort of overlaid biases and understandings that kind of undergird our appreciations of history, and especially when it comes to sort of colonialism and imperialism. You know, so for example, there are existing works out there when it comes to sort of understanding global temperance. And they would say, you know, when it comes to, you know, African tribesmen, for instance, who took to prohibitionism in South Africa or in the Congo. And they would essentially, they would just kind of wave their hands and say, oh, well, this guy, you know, you know, he was a convert to Christianity because of, you know, we had these, you know, you had all these religious missionaries that are out there, and maybe they just took to this new religion with a little bit too much zeal. And the problem that I found with this was that you had individuals, you know, in around the globe, you know, sort of these subaltern populations who were embracing prohibitionism and fighting tooth and nail for prohibitionism, not because they were, you know, they took to Christianity with some sort of unmatched zeal, but because they understand, you know, they understood better than anybody else, you know, the harms that it was causing, right? And so it didn't take necessarily a missionary to come in and say, oh, well, look, you know, we've got this morally upright, you know, position. No, it's just the exact opposite. You know, it was, you know, the indigenous populations were the ones who were fighting against this, even against sort of these missionaries that were there as well. And so it kind of reflected this idea that, you know, when it comes to colonial history, that it was only the colonizer, it was only the missionary, it was only the white people who had, you know, sort of morality, and they had an understanding of the common good, right? And so it kind of disempowered subaltern populations, whether those are Native Americans in the United States or African Americans also in the United States, or if you're talking about, you know, indigenous populations in Botswana or in, you know, in Zimbabwe or in the Congo, you know, that if all your focus is on, you know, sort of the missionaries and the religious elements, you're missing out on, you know, sort of understanding temperance and prohibitionism as this local empowerment movement, you know, by subaltern populations against that sort of predatory capitalism.
Well, the book concludes with sort of three big picture takeaways from this comparative history. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about them, and I would really especially like to talk about the last one, which I just found to be fascinating, and I thought ties very well into a new podcast we have here on the New Books Network called How to Be Wrong. But before we get to that, tell us what are the big picture takeaways at the end of the book?
Part of it is that it highlights some of the shortcomings in the way that we approach history. I guess there are all sorts of sayings that you could wrap into this. The old adage that, war is too important to leave to the generals. You can make sort of a similar argument that history is too important to leave to the historians, that if we just all we do is narrowly focus in on a particular topic or a particular question, and we say, okay, well, temperance and prohibition politics, that's, a niche understanding in American history. And we're just going to, focus in on, this tiny little segment of temperance politics in the United States from 1851 through, 1919. You're missing out on the big picture, right? And you're missing out on how integral it is to all these different elements. And so it really does, it is important to sort of, opening up the sort of the broader scope of not only just American history, but global history as well. And so in some ways, the book, if I were to give you just sort of a snippet on it, I know there's there's this new Matrix movie coming out, right? And it seems to be...
I did not know that. There's another one. Okay, news to me.
They're rebooting sort of the Matrix thing, but it's in many ways it's like that red pill blue pill moment that once you go down, take the red pill, I think understanding prohibition politics is like that red pill for understanding American history, that you're like, okay, something's not right here. The conventional wisdom that we have for what caused prohibition doesn't make any sense, right? The argument is like, well, it's Midwestern evangelical Protestants. That's what it was. It was a reactionary movement. Okay, well then, why was there no great awakening of American Protestantism at that point in time? Why was, then people are like, oh no, it was women, it was women's movement. It's like, that's what it was. It's like, okay, well, but the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote came after the 18th Amendment. And so that doesn't make any sense either, right? And it's like, oh, well, it was anti-German sentiment with World War I. It's like, okay, but the Congress that passed the Prohibition Amendment was elected in 1916, which was before the United States got into World War I. So like all these conventional understandings and even the crowning achievement of the 18th Amendment, if you understand it as a reactionary movement, how do you get the 18th Amendment passed at the height of the progressive era, right? So none of it makes any sense. And so it became like this thing that if we go down the rabbit hole and try to understand sort of the global historical context, all of a sudden, all these things that never made sense in our received wisdom suddenly fall into place. It was, the 18th Amendment came at the height of the progressive era because it was a fundamentally progressive movement against sort of this, big business, this predatory capitalism, this so-called liquor machine. And so all of a sudden, all the things start to fall into place and make sense in a way that they didn't before, to the point where, again, with the red pill, blue pill thing, it's like you can look back, after reading the book, you can look into the Matrix, right? You can look in and read some other historical accounts that just don't get it, right? That they just don't see that, some of these, based upon our previous misconceptions and preconceptions about politics. So for example, I'm looking over here in the corner, I've got David Blight's book on Frederick Douglass, right? It's even bigger than my book. I think it's like 900 pages, right? It won the Pulitzer Prize. It's a great book on Frederick Douglass, tells you everything you ever wanted to know. But nowhere in there does it mention that he was probably the foremost temperance lecturer and prohibitionist of his day. Right? Because that doesn't make sense to the author, right? That if you have this and you've been told for generations that temperance and prohibitionism is a conservative movement, and now you're going to look at, somebody like Frederick Douglass, who is the exact opposite, right? I mean, he's for emancipation, he's for women's rights, he's for civil rights and equality and democracy and all these sorts of things. If you throw in temperance and prohibitionism, that doesn't make sense to the author, right? And so it just kind of gets left out of the book in every way, right? So so if you don't see it as being a central part of, you know, all these reform movements throughout American history, it just kind of gets left by the wayside. And we kind of have this incomplete result of sort of understanding American politics. You know, if we just kind of compartmentalize and put things on and say, oh, this is just a niche thing. This is just some sort of history of zealotry, American zealots, you know, talking about temperance and, you know, wanting to tell people what they can and can't drink. There's quite a bit more to it than that. And once you sort of see that, you know, it opens up so much more, you know, sort of the scope of not only American history, but global history as well.
Well, I'd love to hear just a little, before we go, I'd love to hear just a little bit more about how you came to see that, because the book has, and I hope this isn't a spoiler for our listeners, the book has what I think is a very brave ending in which you state that your first book, which was based on years of dissertation fieldwork and much study, was dead wrong. So can you tell us, how was it dead wrong, and how did you come to realize that?
Yeah, it's not the whole thing was wrong. It was, the fundamental assumptions about temperance, I think, were wrong. You know, and I was able to parrot some of the you know, the conventional wisdom that I was raised on. You know, on understanding temperance and prohibitionism as a, you know, sort of conservative evangelical movement. You know, my first book, which was based on my dissertation, was kind of a comparative analysis of alcohol politics and prohibition politics in the United States, Russia, and Sweden. And the idea was to not just to figure out, you know, what caused these particular outcomes, but to get a better sense of how ideas, you know, and this is, again, sort of that causal political science perspective. How do ideas, policy relevant ideas, get filtered through different institutions? Autocratic institutions in Russia or democratic institutions in the United States or sort of a middle great, you know, middle range sort of institutions in Sweden. How do those ideas lead to policy outcomes? That was kind of the focus, and that really is separate from it. But I admit that I completely bought into sort of the received wisdom when it comes to the foundational assumptions about what caused prohibitionism in the United States. And so I look back and I'm like, yeah, I was wrong about that. That was, you know, you've got a whole podcast now, right? On being wrong. You know, there's this Catherine Schulz book, and she has a great TED talk on this as well. You know, an entire book on being wrong, you know, and recognizing, you know, and the limitations of our knowledge and our understandings. So yeah, you know, at the end of the day, I was, you know, reading more and more into this and you know, recognizing that, hey, I'm not above scrutiny here either. I'm, you know, my previous works were based upon what I thought was the, you know, the correct received wisdom, when it comes to temperance and prohibitionism. But again, instead of just kind of, I don't want to say regurgitating, but, you know, sort of, echoing that understanding, you know, coming at it from sort of a more social science perspective rather than a, you know, humanities perspective or, you know, history perspective. We always talk about trying to minimize errors and trying to minimize the opportunities that we are wrong in our causal inferences. That's why we take big samples, you know, and we think those are more representative. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I can't say with 100% certainty that this is sort of the big T truth, that this is exactly what is, you know, what was actually going on at the time. And, but, you know, the idea is for us to be less and less wrong over time, right? And so I think when it comes to writing some of these, you know, historical understandings, I think, you know, our history of understanding temperance and prohibitionism as a, you know, conservative evangelical movement has been wrong, right? And we need to correct that. And ultimately, the final goal is to be less and less wrong over time. You know, so that was kind of the ultimate goal of my books. And I'll ultimately, if somebody writes another book that suggests that, you know, there are shortcomings in this one, that's part of the process. You know, that's part of the process of moving knowledge forward is, you know, accounting for those errors and, you know, fessing up when, you know, when you've been wrong in the past. And so that's, you know, just, I guess, the old adage that humility is knowledge, recognizing that there are limitations to what we know and what we can know, you know, and trying to just, you know, get smarter over time. That's what lifetime learning is all about, ultimately.
Well, it does. Point of view, it does open up a bunch of new questions for research, more narrower questions that could be explored by historians. And it's just a lot of food for thought for general readers, too. So that brings us to our final traditional question here on the New Books Network. And that is, what are you working on now? What's next?
I've got a lot of, you know, housework that I've put off for a couple of years. No, I've got a lot of stuff that I'm doing here on campus. Looks like I'll be heading up our Russian studies department. I'm sure that will take up quite a bit, a chunk of time. But the other thing I wanted to do, and I'm he's kind of a character in the book. He's almost like, what is it? Virgil in Dante's Inferno. The tour guide through Dante's Inferno and so on. I've got something of a character like that in this book. His name is William E. Pussyfoot Johnson. And with apologies to the Dos Equis beer guy, I think he's the most fascinating guy in the history. And I've been working on writing his biography for a long time, probably as long as I've been writing the previous book. He's just a fascinating historical character. So he pops up intermittently in the book. You know, he's in the chapters on Turkey. He's in the chapters on, obviously throughout the United States history. He went to India and met with the Indian National Congress and went to meet with Gandhi. He spent time in the Russian underground. He was, he was a lawman in the Indian country of Oklahoma. He's just this fascinating guy, and I've been wanting to write his biography for a long time. But when I was coming up for tenure a number of years ago, I had proposed this as my interest. I want to write this guy's biography. He's a fascinating historical character. Gives us a lot of insight into the global history of it. My department chair at that point in time, who's a wonderful guy, he says, that's all well and good, but a biography is not political science. We can't even kind of justify that as being political science. He says, so why don't you focus in on this this project that you're doing that's broadly comparative, that's broadly a political science thing. And he's like, well, once you get tenure, you can write whatever you want. And so he's like, save that one for later. I'm like, okay, I will. I'll save that one for later. So that's what I've been working on for a while. I don't know. When it will see the light of day, but it's a fascinating history of a lesser known figure in global politics.
And it struck me reading the book. I thought reading the book, I said a different version of this book could just be a biography of Pussyfoot Johnson. And so it's a nice coincidence to hear that's happening.
Yeah, he's just a fascinating guy. I've been to his gravesite. I own like everything that I've been able to find. I've been to his house that he built in upstate New York. I've toured it. It's a wonderful place. So he's just, a fascinating historical figure that, before they had Times Person of the Year Award, back in the 1920s, it was the New York Times. They had this, it's very gendered and very specific. It was the 10 most famous American men. That was their list. And Pussyfoot Johnson was on that list along with people like Babe Ruth and Thomas Edison and Teddy Roosevelt. And we know all those names, right? But we don't know this guy. I was like, what happened to him? Where did, why did he go
We got prohibition wrong. Right. So he's just sort of fell out of historical memory. Anyway, right. Fascinating. Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing your work with us. It was a real privilege to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been great.